This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm with Setzer Vima. How are you, Setzer?
Hello, I'm very well. Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm very good, mate. I'm very good. You're in, where are you? Holland at the moment on Zoom.
Yeah, I'm based in Holland.
Yeah.
Yes.
What we're going to talk about today is aromas and wines, and we'll do a bit of a background and we might cover the sort of the primary fruits in the wines. But do you want to just tell us, I know you're a diploma student, but you've got a degree sensory science, a master's in sensory science. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So my bachelor was psychology, actually, and then I moved into my master's studies, which was sensory science. Sensory science is the study about flavor perception. So then you get to learn about how the senses of smell and taste work together to produce a single sensation, which is flavor, which was a 2-year program. And then during the last 6 months, I did an internship in England at the producer of flavor standards. Aroxa is their brand of flavor standards. And then after the internship, I stayed with the company and worked there for a couple of years. And then after that, I decided that it was time to introduce this method in the wine industry. And then I started my own company, The Art of Tasting. I give wine tastings and I provide wine tasting kits. And via those methods, I teach people about aromatic compounds.
Is that mainly for diploma-like students? I would have thought at level 3, it's a little bit less diploma, master of wines, that type of thing.
Level 3 students have told me they find it useful for feeling more confident in passing their tasting exam. Mm. So I guess any qualification where you are being tested on tasting will benefit from this method.
All right, then. Well, let's talk about the flavors and wine. One of the things about the level 4 is they do start to require you to know the difference between different aroma compounds. In fact, I think you were saying earlier that in the textbook, in chapter 11, there's a whole series about what makes up a bottle of wine, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, exactly, yeah.
So today we're going to talk a lot about the different aroma compounds, but what does make up a bottle of wine, Vilma?
It's usually about 85% of water. And when I first heard that, I was almost disappointed. Like, how can something so flavorful be like the majority of water? And what you'll find out is that some of the compounds that make up aroma and flavor of wine, they're present in very, very small quantities, but we're very sensitive to them. So they're nevertheless very important in wine flavor. So then the other component is alcohol. That's the other main component produced during fermentation, contributes to body. But where it gets interesting, and I'm just going from top to bottom in the chapter 11 of wine components, is acids. Mm. And acids are obviously responsible for the acidity in wine, and they come from the grape flesh. Okay, so they come from the inside of the grapes, the grape pulp. And the main acid in wine is tartaric acid. And as the name suggests, it's kind of a tart-like acidity. So it's a very firm acidity, right? Mm. And this is also the most stable acid of all the acids that can be found in wine. And what I mean with that is during grape ripening, this level remains pretty constant,
yep,
as opposed to something like malic acid, which tends to drop during ripening, right?
Yep, yep.
And also during wine making, tartaric acid, that tends to be the acid that doesn't really get metabolized by yeast or bacteria, whereas other acids do. So that brings me to another acid called malic acid. Mm. And in terms of flavor, this is also a tart and firm acidity. And if you would compare them side by side to tartaric and malic acid, they're actually really difficult to tell apart. Okay, so the taste profile is very similar. Malic acid, however, is less stable. So when the grape gets exposed to heat, for example, the malic acid levels tend to drop.
Is that why malic acid is quite common in cool climate wines as opposed to warm climate wines? So you see a lot of malic acid in Chablis and Sancerres, whereas maybe the south of France or South Africa, less so.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's one factor. Then the other factor is that you can also control malic acid levels as a winemaker because it gets metabolized during malolactic conversion. Mm. And that's a step in winemaking where malic acid gets converted into lactic acid. So the total acidity levels drop. You're losing some of the malic acid and you're producing lactic acid. And if you would compare lactic acid and malic acid side by side during a tasting, that difference is much clearer. Okay, so...
Is it much clearer in the taste or in the texture?
This is taste, yeah. So it doesn't contribute to texture all that much. It's more like a pure taste sensation. It also doesn't contribute to smell. Okay, these are non-volatile compounds. So they don't escape the liquid.
Mm-hmm.
They don't contribute to aroma. They only affect the palate.
But a lot of people would say that malic acid... undergoing malolactic conversion will sometimes, if the bacteria is stressed, produce dairy-like flavors. So is that different to the malic acid? That's just a byproduct of that consumption?
Yes, so I think what you're referring to is a compound called diacetyl.
Yes.
And diacetyl is produced by lactic acid bacteria alongside lactic acid.
Mm.
And that is an aroma compound. So indeed, that's something you would be able to smell. And it smells of butter.
But it's not the acid itself. It's a byproduct of that process.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we've covered the most important acids in terms of taste. But then there are also volatile acids. So those are acids that can actually escape the liquid. And the most important one is acetic acid.
Mm-hmm.
So it smells of vinegar, right? It's sometimes people get sort of a cider-like association with acetic acid. And this is mainly produced by acetic acid bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
These are bacteria that require oxygen to produce acetic acid. So acetic acid is often a result of oxidation and alongside microbial activity. And then acetic acid also reacts with alcohol to form ethyl acetate, which smells of nail varnish remover.
Yes.
And those two compounds together make up volatile acidity. Okay, acetic acid and ethyl acetate. Ethyl acetate is classified as an ester, so that's the chemical class.
Okay, and which one gives the slightly bruised apple-type smell?
Oh, that's a different compound called acetaldehyde.
Because most people think of wines that are oxidizing as developing that sort of slightly bruised smell.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And the compound responsible is acetaldehyde, and I'll discuss that in a little bit during when we discuss primary aromas.
Okay.
Shall we move on to discussing some aromas?
Yes, yes. So the key thing here is that there is a series of chemicals that give different aromas. So sometimes people talk about terpenes, or they might talk about esters, as you were touching on earlier.
Yeah.
There's loads of different ones, and some grape varieties have different types of chemicals in them, which is why some grape varieties taste different. Is that right?
Yeah, 100%.
Cool.
Yeah. You will be familiar with the classification of primary, secondary, and tertiary aromas.
Yep. Primary is your fruit, secondary is winemaker influence, and tertiary is sort of age and characteristics.
Absolutely. So within primary, you can distinguish three categories of aromas, right? Those that come from the grapes, those that come from precursors in grapes, and then those that are formed during fermentation. So they're all primary aromas. And maybe I should give some examples. So aromas from grapes, those would be aromas that you can actually taste in the grapes if you would be in the vineyard and just pick grapes from the vine. And a well-known class of compounds is those called methoxypyrazines. And particularly isobutyl methoxypyrazine, which is also known as bell pepper pyrazine. And guess what? It smells of a green bell pepper.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is a compound that's found in the Sauvignon family of grapes.
Yeah.
So think Sauvignon Blanc, but also Cabernet Sauvignon and Carmenere. And it's associated with ripeness. And think of a green bell pepper, which is basically the unripe version of a red bell pepper. So it makes sense that when your grapes, and particularly those Sauvignon Blanc or Cabernet Sauvignon grapes, if they're less ripe, you'll have higher levels of methoxypyrazines. And they smell of green bell pepper, but also like green beans. Like green beans before you boil them have exactly the same smell.
Now, you mentioned that Sauvignon is, and Sauvignon group grapes varieties like Sauvignon, yes. Cabernet Sauvignon, Sauvignon Blanc, and you even mentioned Carmenere, which I didn't realize is part of the family. They all produce this green bell pepper.
Yeah.
Do other grape varieties produce methoxypyrazines?
Not really in any significant quantities.
Okay.
No.
Okay, so if you get green bell pepper, you're going Sauvignon Blanc, Carmenere, or Cabernet Sauvignon, nice and easy.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So it could, that, absolutely, it could be a marker during blind tasting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. So another example from primary aroma from the grape is called Rotundone. And that's a very unique compound that you find in specific grape varieties as well. And it's often responsible for an aroma of peppercorn. So, for example, in Syrah or in red grape varieties, it comes across as black pepper.
What's the chemical group called again? You mentioned it. I didn't quite catch that.
The compound is called Rotundone.
Rotundone? I've never heard of that one.
It sounds catchy, doesn't it?
Now, tell me, is that a bit like that black pepper? Because, for example, Northern Rhone, the good quality wines from Northern Rhone often have a black pepper note. But if you get yourself into Australia and you're drinking an Aussie Shiraz, they don't often have that. Is that a bit like the bell pepper from the methoxypyrazines, where cooler climates are more likely to have that black pepper smell than the warmer climates?
Yeah, I think that's a really good comparison. So they develop in much the same way, the methoxypyrazines and Rotundone. So cooler climate indeed will give you higher levels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it just black pepper that those Rotundones smell of?
Not really. I was just about to touch into that. So whenever I use Rotundone in my tastings, then first of all, not everyone gets Rotundone. And there have some studies published on this, and it is thought that at least 20%, maybe even up to 40% of the population has specific anosmia towards Rotundone.
Mm.
And what that means, specific anosmia, is that you're unable to detect a specific aromatic compound. So you're blind. It's much like color blindness,
yeah,
where you can't pick up certain colors, specific anosmia, that you can't pick up certain aromatic compounds. So the anosmia rate for Rotundone is particularly high. That means like 1/3 of all wine tasters simply don't have the genetic makeup to be able to detect the compound at all. So maybe you're familiar with that if you're in a Syrah tasting and everyone around you says, I can smell black pepper, and you're not sure. Then it could be that you're unable to pick up a Rotundone.
Okay.
And then even if you pick up the compound, if you're able to detect it, not everyone describes it as black pepper. Some people, for example, say patchouli oil.
What?
Patchouli oil.
Patchouli oil? What the hell is that?
So it's an ingredient in perfumery, right?
Yeah.
And Rotundone is also present in that particular plant, as well as some other plants. So some people describe it as more woody or more floral,
mm-hmm,
and they don't necessarily get the black pepper association. So black pepper is sort of the go-to descriptor for Rotundone, but it doesn't fit everyone.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a one-size-fits-all descriptor, okay, if that makes sense.
Like in Northern Rhone, I often get things like violets or some floral notes in there. Is that a Rotundone or is that more blackberry? I've just mislabeled blackberry.
So it's a combination of two compounds. That would be partly Rotundone. And then there's also another interesting compound called beta-ionone. And I don't think that's in the specification of wine production D1. But I'll mention it anyway. This is a degradation compound of carotenes, right? So color pigments in the skin,
yeah,
that degrade and then produce this violet note. Also has a pretty high specific anosmia rate. So not everyone picks up the violet character.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
So that would be the specific compound responsible for the violet,
okay,
aroma.
All right, that makes sense because I get it a lot in some wines and some people don't get them at all. So that the fact that there's quite a big hole in people's palate for violet makes sense.
Yeah. And it also explains because it's present in the skins that you typically don't find a violet character in white wines. It's more of a character in red wines.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll move on to some other aromas.
Yeah, definitely. This is interesting.
Brilliant. Okay. So then there are aromas that come from precursors in grapes.
Yeah.
So let me define what a precursor is. It is a compound that becomes something else during a chemical conversion, right? So in other words, it's your starting material. It's a building block and it becomes another product.
The key thing with the precursors is they're not normally volatile. I always think of precursors bound, yeah, up with sugar molecules for some reason. Sometimes they're bound up with sugar molecules and therefore they're too heavy. They're not volatile. And during the alcoholic fermentation, that breaks the bond. This is the way I think about it. I don't know if it's right. And then during the fermentation, it breaks the bond and all of a sudden those aromas can become volatile.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah.
So that's the case with terpenes.
Terpenes, yeah?
So, yes, terpenes. And a nice example of a terpene is geraniol. Geraniol smells of rose, so it has a very floral character. And is indeed bound, as you say, to a sugar group. Now, during fermentation, yeast is interesting in accessing that sugar group, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. So it has an enzyme that breaks up that connection between the sugar group and geraniol. Yeast is not interested in geraniol, so just gets rid of geraniol, but then it can metabolize the sugar that's left. But before, geraniol bound to that sugar group is not volatile, so you won't be able to smell it. But then during fermentation, it's untrapped, and then it starts to contribute to wine flavor.
And that's terpenes. But you mentioned, geraniol? Is that like geranium? Is that just like geranium? Because geranium is normally considered a fault.
It's a little bit, the name is a little bit confusing. It's because it has been identified in geraniums. They call it geraniol, but if you smell the compound, everyone says rose. It smells like rose.
Okay, rose. Yep.
It's not the same compound as the geranium taint that you're talking about, which is considered a fault indeed.
Okay, and you mentioned terpenes, and I always think of terpenes more as those like kerosene and oily flavors you get with Rieslings. Are they terpenes, or is it just that they're like a terpene in real life, but they don't smell like it?
The Riesling flavor of kerosene is another compound called TDN. And it's short for tetradihydronaphthalene, and it's a different class of chemical compound.
Okay. The terpene like smells you get in Riesling aren't the terpenes. Terpenes are more like a rose smell. Yeah, just for clarification. No, that's right. As long as I understand, that's cool.
No, that's interesting. Sometimes the naming of the flavor doesn't necessarily tell you what it smells like.
Yeah,
it could be where it is first identified, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it smells that way.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense.
So other aromas from precursors is this compound called 4-MMP, which is short for 4-mercaptomethylpentanone, for your interest. So it is classified as a thiol. And this thiol is bound to an amino acid called cysteine. And it forms in much of the same way as terpenes. So 4-MMP bound to cysteine gets metabolized by the yeast. It breaks up that connection, and then 4-MMP gets released into the wine, and then it will start to contribute to aroma. And it smells of box tree or gooseberries or elderflower, and even at higher concentrations, Gatsby. Yep. So this is the aroma that you find in Sauvignon Blanc specifically. It's sort of the other side of Sauvignon Blanc next to methoxypyrazines. Mm-hmm. And it contributes to Sauvignon Blanc character. Then there are aromas that are formed specifically during fermentation. So those are aromas that are unrelated to the grape variety, but it's simply a byproduct of fermentation. And an important group of compounds are known as esters. Mm-hmm. And we briefly mentioned that before. So ethyl acetate, that's an important ester, which gives this nail varnish character. But other esters are, for example, isoamyl acetate. And that's the compound that smells of banana, kind of like synthetic bananas, like confectionery bananas.
Yeah, yeah. You normally associate that with carbonic maceration, that banana-y smell, but you do see it in other places.
Yeah, in red wines, absolutely, yeah. And in white wines, it's more associated with lower fermentation temperatures mm-hmm. because those are known to retain those esters much more.
Yes, because they're quite volatile, so they'll boil off in a warmer firm.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, and lower temperatures, people often talk about pear drops, and if you drink a lot of Prosecco, you know, Prosecco smells of pear a lot, and I always associate that with cool fermentation temperatures.
Yeah, although pear drops don't necessarily smell and taste all that much of pear, because they're flavored with the same compound, isoamyl acetate. So it's more like a banana character. It's kind of referring to the same aroma. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, but indeed, it is produced using lower fermentation temperatures.
Okay, so there's a load of compounds that are nothing to do with the grape. They're just a function of it. We touched on some volatile acidities. I always think of fermentations that are struggling are going to produce higher levels of volatile acidity. So if you're making a sweet wine, you often see it in sweet wines because that's a very toxic environment for a yeast to live in a fermenting a sweet wine. And things like that. So is that, you're aware of that or?
It can happen. although reduction is more closely associated with stuck fermentations and struggling fermentations. If you link a specific fault to a struggling fermentation, it's usually reduction.
Okay. I just know it because a lot of some sauternes and things like that, where you get that sort of gingery note on the back of the throat. It's not really a flavor. It's like a got you in the back of the throat. And I always associate that with VA, and I see that a lot in sweet wines. In my tasting notes, I call it ginger because it's like a spice on the back of the throat, but it's not really a proper ginger flavor.
I'm not sure, but it could well be acetic acid because it has sort of this stinging character to it. It can sort of attack your nose in a way.
Yes.
So maybe that's related to acetic acid. Apart from esters, we get alcohol, of course, which is produced during fermentation. And there is an interesting compound called acetaldehyde, which we briefly mentioned, which is the intermediate product in the conversion from sugar to alcohol. Okay, so yeast converts sugar into acetaldehyde into alcohol. That's sort of the simplified version of fermentation. So when there is high levels of acetaldehyde, it could mean two things. First, your fermentation is not yet complete. So you're dealing with a very, very young wine that's maybe bottled too early. Or second, it's also the oxidation product of alcohol. So we could also be looking at an oxidized wine if it's high in acetaldehyde. And common descriptors of acetaldehyde are bruised apple or a green apple, like a Granny Smith apple, as well as emulsion paint and carved pumpkin. So,
carved pumpkin?
Yeah, the inside of a pumpkin. Yeah, it smells of acetaldehyde.
Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it's the same as a green apple, but they both contain the same compound as acetaldehyde.
So green apple, you see that in a lot of cool climate wines, you know, Chablis or even Sancerres, or, you know, sort of those quite cool climate wines. Why would they be more prevalent in a cooler climate wine than maybe in a warmer climate wine?
So acetaldehyde is present in all wines, right? So this is a compound common to all wines. And maybe at low levels, it will contribute to a green apple flavor. But a green apple flavor is the result of many different compounds that are present at the same time. So acetaldehyde, but also some esters. Ethyl hexanoate, for example, is an ester that smells of apple. And probably also some other compounds that make it sort of a more genuine green apple character. But there are a lot of factors involved in how the climate contributes to that. And that's a little bit more difficult to explain because it's not simply one compound that's responsible for this character.
Yeah, okay.
If that answers your question.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Yeah. That's good.
Okay. So shall we move on to some secondary aromas?
Yes, yeah. Oh, actually, before we move on to that, can you explain to me, and WSD believe this is quite, well, certainly at level 3 anyway, that as you move through climates, you often see a progression of flavors. Quite often the flavors might start out a little bit floral, then move to then green fruits, then citrus, then stone fruits, then tropical fruits.
Yeah.
Clearly there's different chemistry going on there. Why is it that you see a progression of flavor changes in your primary aromas?
We know that certain compounds are responsible for those aromas you just described, but this is kind of a grayer area, right? So not all aromas that are in your systematic approach to tasting are directly linked to a single aromatic compound. No. So it's much more difficult to research them. And so that's probably the sort of maybe slightly unsatisfying answer to your question is we don't exactly know what the chemistry behind tropical fruits are. Or stone fruits or orchard fruits.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, specific chemicals, because I always think of an aroma as like a magic door with a load of different keys. And if you use a certain set of combinations, you open the door up and you get pineapple. You shut it, you use a different set of keys, or maybe just change one key and you land up with mango or something like that. I always think of it a bit like that.
I like that analogy. Yeah.
Okay, Seth, so I think we'll leave it there. Next week, I think we're going to talk a wee bit about maybe the secondary aromas in wine. We've talked about the primaries, and next week we'll talk about the secondaries, okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool.